Welcome to the final episode of the four-part Ira Bewley series on the Warrior Next Door podcast. In episode 3, we heard about Ira's squadron attacking Guam, his impressions of napalm, as well as the preparatory bombing of Iwo Jima, the Philippines, and New Guinea in late summer 1944. In this final episode, Ira talks about attacking Chichijima and the resulting atrocities perpetrated on the captured U.S. airmen, as well as transitioning back to the U.S. to train new crews.
This is the Warrior Next Door podcast, where we feature oral histories from veterans whose stories provide an intimate look at world history and how it still affects us today. All the veterans featured in this podcast were interviewed by us while serving as volunteers for the Folk Life Center at the Library of Congress. Our interviews, almost 200 in total, were conducted with veterans who lived in our cities, our neighborhoods, and often, you guessed it, right next door to us. Welcome to our journey.
Next clip that we're going to pull into is they already rampaged the Philippines. They rampaged the Iwo Jima. And now they're going to go and rampage Chichijima, which was made infamous for a number of reasons, and you're going to hear that right now.
In August of 1944, we had word that there was quite a fleet, Japanese ships, warships, in the harbor there. And we were within about 300-400 miles at the time. So we raced up there one night, and I believe there were 5 planes from our ship assigned to that job, and there was about 70 or 80 planes total from other carriers. And I was flying with the skipper of the Air Group 31, and he was a good pilot. He come in, and he always went in first. He didn't ask anybody else to lead as long as he was flying in the group. And he dropped his torpedo and got a good hit. And the destroyer, it was a large destroyer, and it heaved up out of the water and broke in half. Mm-hmm. But it was anchored in that harbor.
Which harbor was this? In the Philippines?
Chichijima.
Chichijima, okay.
Mm-hmm. But we lost one crew during that deal, and I didn't see anybody go down, because it was partially cloudy, a little foggy, raining a little bit. But after that, another plane from the Yorktown said that he saw a torpedo bomber go down, and it had to be them, you know, because they never showed up. And they were captured. They made a fairly good water landing, were captured. After the war, the pilot, he said, I'm gonna find out what happened to the South. And he wrangled some kind of position in naval intelligence. And he attended the war crime trial. They found out that all 3 of them were beheaded.
Yeah, we'll get to that part in a second. I want to go back to the beginning of the clip and talk a little bit more about what they did at Chichijima. Chichijima said there's a number of ships in the harbor there, and there were. And in fact, after their air group went through there and attacked Chichijima, they sank 4 cargo ships, 3 destroyers, 1 light cruiser, 5 troop barges, and a bunch of auxiliary vessels were sunk. So it was a small fleet. And their pilot, Edward Wood, sank one of the destroyers, a Matsui-class destroyer. It was considered a destroyer escort, but the Japanese destroyer escorts were about as big as our destroyers.
I'm just going to say, and he mentioned that he flew with the skipper. That's who he's talking about, is Lieutenant Wood. And that's the fellow he was riding with.
Totally. And I'm going to the webpage at the VEF31.com, and it reads, Lieutenant Edward E. Wood, commanding officer of ET-31, is credited with sinking Matsu-class destroyer escort in the attack. And so when he talked about this destroyer blowing up and bucking up and breaking in half, Those are bombs doing that. They did that, which was pretty amazing. Again, you think about all the effort, materiel, the men, the training that go into producing a destroyer, and three men and an Avenger dive on it and sink it in a matter of minutes. That and apparently every other bloody ship in the frickin' harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of the other things that he talks about were the beheadings.
The Chichijima incident. So just a few words on that. In around September of 1944, nine airmen were shot down. Maybe three Avengers. I don't know since there's three apiece. They escaped their planes and they were bombing Chichijima, which was known to be a difficult place to bomb because they'd have to come inside this kind of high walled sort of harbor, and they were vulnerable to the guns, the anti-aircraft fire right there. So this island is only about 700 miles south of Tokyo. So we're getting pretty close to the home islands here. Eight of the airmen out of the nine were captured, and they are Lloyd Wolhoff, Grady York, James Dye, Glenn Fraser, Marv Mershon, Floyd Hall, and Warren Earl Vaughn. The ninth person who escaped and evaded capture was George H.W. Bush.
Mm.
After the war, it was discovered that the captured airmen had been beaten and tortured before being executed. And that's the beheadings that Tony was just talking about. The airmen were beheaded on the orders of Lieutenant General Yoshio Tachibana. And the Japanese officers then ate parts of the bodies of the four men. So that's if you read the book Flyboys by James Bradley, he talks about this story and it goes into all of the detail and all the research behind it.
And that's not the only occurrence of ritualistic cannibalism that the Japanese were found guilty of. And in fact, after the war, when we had, war crime trials against the Japanese, a number of Japanese generals, officers and enlisted men were hanged and executed. For cannibalism, that's what they were found guilty of, was eating soldiers. And then in addition to that, men were found guilty of beheading, torturing, killing, not just here, but everywhere. I read a book, I can't remember which one it was, years ago, about why the Japanese did this. They did the same thing on Wake Island. Wake Island was an island that they captured early in the war.
Within a day or two of December 7th.
Absolutely. And they held the island the entire war. And what would happen was every time the American fleet would sortie out of Pearl Harbor, they'd go by Wake Island on their way to the Gilberts, the Marshalls, the Marianas, wherever they were going. And they would use it for bombing practice. It was just a way to warm up. The Japanese soldiers that were on that island got so frustrated by being impotent and stuck and stranded on this island that they took it out on some of the POWs, some of whom were actually Korean workers that were brought in to help with some of the defensive positions. And they did the same thing. And I begin to wonder if this is the mindset of the Japanese at this time on Chichijima, where they were getting bombed so hopelessly, they really weren't getting any support. And this was their only outlet. This was the general's way of letting the men blow off some steam. It's wrong. It's terrible. Bad shit happens, especially in war. But that's something I remember reading about years ago that I think that might explain the psychology. The eating part, yeah. I mean, I don't think our modern mind can get our brain around that anymore.
So I know in the book Flyboys, they talk about the fact that Chichijima had been cut off. You know, they were on their own. And quite frankly, the Japanese garrison there was starving to death. And I choose to think that perhaps some of this might have just been delirium on their part, you know, and knowing that they've got some protein.
Well, in Rabaul, that was isolated earlier in the war, and the Japanese committed cannibalism there on their own soldiers to stay alive. And this goes back to what we were saying earlier about the airmen during the Second Battle of the Philippine Sea, how they were able to feel comfortable that, look, if I take a splash in the water, my country is going to do everything they can to get me back on that carrier. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese philosophy was completely different. If you were cut off, there was no rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
As far as they were concerned, you were still holding ground. That was Fortress Rabaul or Fortress Wake Island. And so, yeah, I think the Japanese, regardless of what was inculcated in them as they were growing up during this period of history, were still human beings and still would have felt the frustration from that.
So what occurred with this Japanese garrison, and most notably Tachibana, who was the guy who was involved in the cannibalism here and the torture and the beheading? Well, after the war, Tachibana, along with 11 other Japanese personnel, were tried in August of 46 in relation to the execution of the Navy airmen and the cannibalism of at least one of them during August of 44. This is all from Wikipedia here. So because military and international law did not specifically deal with cannibalism, they were tried for murder and, quote, prevention of honorable burial, unquote.
Oh, wow.
The case was investigated in 1947 in a war crimes trial, and of 30 Japanese soldiers prosecuted, four officers, including Tachibana, were found guilty and hanged. All enlisted men and the probationary medical officer were released within 8 years.
Wow. No, I didn't know that. Okay. Well, this is really the end of the engagements for Ira Bewley and Air Group 31. They had spent a little over 9 months in the Pacific.
And what a 9 months he was involved in.
Absolutely. They never had leave. They never stood on land. The entire 9 months, they were on the aircraft carrier or in the air. And now their tour of duty was complete. So they fought in the Marshalls. They fought in the Marianas. They did participated in the Marianas turkey shoot. And then they went through and literally just ravaged the Philippines, Chichijima, Iwo Jima. And now it's time to go home. So this next clip is going to talk a bit about his transition from being in the front line to the war is still going on. This would have been around December of 1944 to January 1945. So we still have till August until the war ends. But his current tour is over, but not the war. And he doesn't know when the war is going to end. So he just knows that he's going back home to repair, refit, do some things with the thought that maybe they're going to go back out into the Pacific. He doesn't know that at this point. But at any rate, they're heading back to the States.
He said, well, if you fellas don't want to fly anymore, I'll send you to San Diego. So we went over to San Diego, and we got in a ground crew, mechanics, and worked there about 4 months. And then one night, a chief that we got to know pretty good, he come around and told us, say, you better want to move. So no, where were we going? And he says, there's a little naval air base in Long Beach, California. And he said, it's the best little base in the Navy. And we got a want for two mechanics up there. And he said, it'd be good duty. We told him, okay, sign us up. And we went up there, and I stayed there the remainder of the war.
Was it good duty?
Anyway, it was good duty. It sure was. And we were
California girls.
I hope we done some good. But we were assigned to squadrons that were getting ready to go out to sea. They were finishing up their last training. And we talked to them about an hour a day, what we'd seen, and things to watch for, things that could happen to you. And that's about all we did, except be sure that the plane that they were using got required maintenance.
Well, you know, I think one of the big takeaways from you know, this little snippet that Ira shares is how, you know, he spends 9 months in the theater and he gets to rotate back and transfer that knowledge to these new green crews that are about to go out to the Pacific where he just came from. The ability of the U.S. to have that sort of resource available to them, where we could just keep pouring the steam on the enemy and take all of our experienced pilots, bring them back, and train up the next group of guys.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It is that we're able to do that and that we consider that to be important. You know, most people don't go to war. Most people haven't served in the military. So let me give an example of something that might resonate with more people in terms of how important this is and what it means. Imagine you go into school for chemical engineering or accounting or whatever. One of the questions that a lot of people who go to school ask is how is the stuff that I'm learning going to translate to what I'm going to do in my career? What sort of, I'm going through this training, I'm learning all this stuff.
That's a good point.
But as I roll in as a mechanical engineer at GE, you know, what do I really need to know? What do I need to do? So on one hand, you can just never know that, have a lot of anxiety and apprehension and go there and kind of figure out along the way. Or you can have a recruiter come in and tell you, hey, if you go to work at GE, these are the things we need you to do. We need you to go to this floor. You're going to work on this project. These are the sort of things we need you to put together. It's really going to set your mind at ease. It's going to allow these guys to understand more fully what they're up against. And then they can focus more on learning other things, like how to land on a carrier in the middle of the night, you know? So,
right. Well, I mean, I'd also say, you know, I would imagine that these guys are doing lectures for these guys and saying, here's what you do if, you know, you have to bail out. You know, I mean, here's what I did. There's bound to have been some stuff transferred here where it's stuff that they were being, you know, that was real boots on the ground, so to speak, boots in the water, experience of how to go about things, you know, that was different than what they were being taught in a classroom in their training. This is practical, real world experience that gives these guys a leg up going in.
Yeah. And this dude rolls in there like a boss. He's able to say, I've been in the plane that sank a destroyer with its bombs.
I got a distinguished flying cross.
I got a distinguished flying
cross.
And
a silver star.
Yes. That, by the way, if you go to the website, he wasn't just decorated with the distinguished flying cross. He's one of the few sailors that also had a silver star. I don't have any information on that. I'm going to try to dig it up. But the bottom line is these guys, if they had any sense, would have really wanted to listen to what he had to say. Because these guys were being trained on how to bomb flat tops and drop napalm, and this cat had done it.
You know, for all we know, Ira mentioned there was a crew that their pilot got knocked out, and the two other crew pulled him out, and they got the silver star. That may have been him.
It may have been him.
He was just demurring.
Yeah, because he did that earlier. It for people listening to the podcast, you're not hearing the entire interview. You're hearing clips that we're pulling out. There are certain times earlier in the interview where the things he did, he wouldn't use the word he. He'd say they or us. Or we, and it wasn't until later the interview and some of my own research I realized, no, it was you.
That
you
was
did
you.
That. Yeah, you shot that down. Your plane did
God
those
bless
things.
Them, you know.
So, any rate, really interesting clip on what the United States military generally is able to do to get their soldiers prepared, and they did it. Now, the next one, the next clip is going to focus a little more on some of the differences in the training between Americans and the Japanese at this point in the war.
Now, you spoke earlier about the Japanese pilots were green and that you slaughtered them in the battle in the Marianas.
Yep.
And then later, you come home and they're able to take an experienced guy like you to help train these pilots. At that point, did you know that the Japanese were licked because we're able to do things like that?
Well, we knew that they were in trouble. Fuel-wise, that was one of the big things we knew. Because, you know, you can strafe an airplane with a full tank of gas and you get a good flare-up. And if that tank is empty, you get an explosion. And many of these airfields that we were bombing, up and down the Philippines, New Guinea, down in that area, that's what we saw. So we knew that they were hurting for fuel. Also, well, we picked up this Japanese pilot, and he had only 60 hours flying time from day one, you know, and he didn't have much training. And about all they were good for was what they finally did, and that make kamikazes out of. But they just didn't have the, they wouldn't run on us there in the last months. If there was more than one plane, they wouldn't tackle us. So it was a matter of they were running out of supplies.
So let's unpack this. What he said at the very end was they were so poorly trained that unless they had overwhelming superiority, the Japanese wouldn't even attack the Americans. They would flare off. And there probably wasn't any theater where they would have had anything that looked like air superiority to even do those sort of attacks. The other thing you mentioned was the 60 hours as the average training for the Japanese. I did a little research on that. It's like, well, how much training did we get? And it turns out that throughout the course of the war, the minimum amount of flight hours that our pilots received was 200. And it wasn't uncommon for certain types of units to get up to 350 flight hours.
Wow.
Before they went into the war. So let's just use some average between the two. And let's just call it, 275, 300 flight hours. You know, that's five times what experience that the average Japanese had. And the Japanese really couldn't afford to have more than 60 flight hours because they were running out of fuel.
Yeah.
They couldn't burn the fuel. They didn't have the resource to do it. And the other thing that I checked on the German front, what was it like for the Germans? It turns out that earlier in the war, 43, 44, early 44, they were, about 270 hours of flight training. By the end of 1944, it was down to 100. Mm. So you had the same thing going on in both theaters, in Germany and Japan. Both countries were becoming resource poor. They were becoming increasingly squeezed. And now this is this death spiral where not only do you not have the ability to replace your human and your material resources, you can't even train them as well as this other force, the Americans or the British that you're fighting.
Because you don't have the resources.
Can't do it. Yeah.
And the other thing he mentioned was, when they would strafe these planes on these airfields, if they were sitting there with a full tank of gas, they would get a flare. The planes would just, they'd light up and they would get a great big flame. If they were empty, then there was just fumes in the tank, and that was more explosive. So when they'd hit these planes, they would explode. And he noticed that all these planes they were strafing were exploding. Well, when you have a line of planes and your job is to get those planes in the air if you're being attacked, you want them fueled, sitting there fueled all the time. These planes were sitting there empty, not because they wanted to, but because they did not have the gas to put in it.
Yeah, yeah. And it wouldn't surprise me. I don't know if this is true. Right now I'm speaking hypothetically. It wouldn't surprise me if at that point of the war, if there was some sort of fuel depot that they intentionally didn't put fuel in those planes because they were being strafed so frequently that they'd lose the planes and the gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
At this point in the war, they might have been willing to give up some of the aircraft that were getting strafed and blown up just so they could keep the fuel reserves to keep the ones that they did have flying. I don't know. I'm speaking hypothetically, but I could see that mindset happening when you're dealing with a mindset of scarcity.
I know that in The Red Sun Setting, the book that I read for this interview and everything, they talked about even the Japanese fleet was concerned about fuel for their own ships. So they turned and left at one point rather than continuing on because as they continued on, they were going more into American territory and it's going to be tougher for them to be able to refuel and refit. So they turned and left after that first day.
Yeah, and it's amazing how all these things we're talking about that the Japanese had to deal with that were deficits on their part in order to prosecute a war, that all of this turned all within a period of about 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
It went from them dominating most of the Pacific and Southeast Asia to what we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
So the next clip is something that a lot of veterans we interview have talked about.
Well, do you mind if I ask you some questions about some things that you told me earlier?
Yeah.
First off, your first combat mission, could you describe to me how you felt and what the mission was?
Well, I felt I wasn't apprehensive about it. Or we'd been trained, and we'd had emergencies along the way in training. And I think most of us took it a day at a time. And we didn't think too much about it. But we had three people that knew that they were coming back. Hmm. And none of the three come back. So whether they had premonition, I don't know. But they knew something evidently. One fellow gave a buddy of mine a dollar bill. So this is all the money I've got. And they were going on flight. And that I won't need this anymore.
Wow.
And they got shot out.
Wow.
You know, we covered this in the Harvey Hunt series. He had a series of stories like this in there. And this is a recurring theme, you know, with these guys. It's just, you know, whether it's, you know, I know Tony's got a perspective on this, but whether it's, you know, God talking to these guys or whether it's just them being so finely tuned in to their environment that they kind of can sense what's coming. You know, everybody has these situations where with your spouse or whoever, you think something in your head, and then all of a sudden your spouse says something that was exactly what the same topic you were thinking of. Maybe that's just the way the brain works and everyone's flows in a certain pattern. Or you could also think maybe that was a little bit of ESP going on there. Maybe there's something that we obviously can't grasp here that's going on.
Yeah, we hear this over and over and over again, this idea, this fighting set of ideas between divine intervention and just dumbass luck or fate or whatever you want to call it. And it's really fascinating to listen these veterans talk about it. And Ryan and I were kicking this around last night. You know, if you look at, let's go back to 1944 and let's say the world had, let's say the United States had 180 million people, 12 million of those fought under arms. Of those 12 million, maybe a million were in kind of a, maybe 2 million were in a day-to-day struggle at any time on a front line where they could be, where they could die. When you eliminate all those people who are living their lives and not facing death every day and just focus on that small subset of people who are facing death, violent, horrible deaths day in and day out, I think these sort of thoughts start to become more focused. They start to burn a little hotter, a lot hotter, in fact, than anything we experience in civilian life. So Ryan and I talked about this. We're going to do a compilation or a theme-based podcast later. We're going to capture a bunch of these clips and discuss them. And in fact, our very next podcast has one of these moments as well. And he has a completely different take on what he thinks is happening. So anyway, we just wanted to play this because it's something we hear these vets talk about a lot, no matter what war you're in. The next clip is going to focus on his reminiscence about what he felt like was the most frightening thing Ira experienced during the entire war.
What was the probably the hairiest or most, you know, frightening moment that you experienced during all these attacks and bombing runs? Were there any missions that were particularly, you know, more dangerous than others?
Well, I would say the night that we had to come in and land on the carrier, because so many planes hit in the water, you know, and our tank was empty. Our motor died when they were putting us in the parking area.
So could you see them turn the lights on, or did you just go over there?
Yeah, they turned the motor lights on the deck of carrier. When you get in the right position, well, it shows up just like a neon sign. You can see that carrier deck real well. And they had those on, and they had some searchlights on, which was, if I'd have been mate, sir, I don't know whether I'd done that or not, but he gambled. And there wasn't any subs in here.
Yeah, so we're back to the Second Battle of Philippine Sea on June 20th, 1944. All the missions he flew, the flak he encountered, the fighters he shot down. And the experience that frightened him the most that you remember all these years was coming back to a carrier group in the middle of the Pacific with no moon and no gas. And what I want to add is just, these are just a couple of firsthand personal accounts that came from Ian Toll's book about what some of these men faced as they were making this long and lonely flight back in the middle of the night. So he quotes, on the long return flight in gathering darkness, American warplanes coalesced into small groups. All of them adjusted their engines to quote-unquote slow cruise to try to coax every possible mile of each gallon of remaining gasoline. One pilot who was battling battle fatigue breathed pure oxygen through his mask, even though he's flying at 2,000 feet. Usually you don't need oxygen until you're above 10. They're just trying to stay awake. They're trying to stay alert, because not only did they have to find the carrier, but they had to land on the damn thing. So the radio circuits remained busy as pilots discussed their predicament. Hours passed. Fuel needles dipped towards empty. Entire sections or squadrons decided to ditch their planes together in one location, reasoning that several rafts lashed together was easier to spot. So they proactively decided to crash, sure, as opposed to waiting to crash, so they could dictate the terms of how they're going to survive on the ocean. One of the pilots recalled that on the radio, some of the men were breaking down, sobbing on the air. It was dark, and the ocean was black out there.
How frightening would that be?
He could totally empathize with them. I mean, think about, I don't think we can think about it. We can try to empathize with this idea that you just survive this attack. You can't see anything. It's a moonless night. You're running out of fuel. You've got this huge, giant, scary ocean that's thousands of feet deep. It's full of sharks, maybe Japanese ships, and you're crashing into it. And so even those pilots with enough fuel to get home, they weren't done yet.
Right.
Flying in darkness was a new experience for all but a few of them. Some of them were drawn off course by lightning flashes on the southern horizons, but those who flew long That's enough right. could pick up a homing beacon emanated from the ships that helped them. And what they would have seen if they had made it that far, and Ira did, is described by Lieutenant John A. Harper. He writes, "It was a scene no witness would ever forget. The great fleet, spread across the horizon as far as the eye could see, made a phantasmagoric spectacle." God, I love that word. Phantasmagoric spectacle. Lieutenant John A. Hopper, landing signal officer in Abella Wood, thought it looked like a big city at night. Hal Buell, approaching from the westward in his damaged 2B-2C, a hell diver, basically, was reminded of Coney Island on the 4th of July. It looked like Mardi Gras. So the bottom line is that when they were able to actually see the fleet, because they turned the lights on, the effect was obvious and apparent. It was just trying to get there.
Right.
And when you're flying hundreds of miles back, you got to be about 15 miles or so within sight of the ships before you can see that part of it, mm-hmm, and know that at least you can see the darn ships. Then you got to land on the damn thing.
Well, and then to boot, which ship is my ship?
Yeah.
I'm from the Cabot. Which one's the Cabot? You know, I've got a few firsthand accounts here from Red Sun Setting. This is page 184, but it talks about the Cabot, actually, that it had an interesting night landing 9 planes, only 2 of which were her own. One of those would have been
Ira's.
That was their own. 2 of the planes were the big SB-2C types that were not supposed to be able to operate from a narrow deck light carrier.
Right.
But the Cabot got them on, though a Yorktown dive bomber that took the barrier had to be pushed over the side to make room for the rest of the carrier's guests. One of the funnier moments of the night involved a Cabot pilot when he arrived over Task Force 58. Beast Russell, love that name, decided he was going to pick out the biggest carrier he could find to land on. The Cabot was just a bit short and narrow for his peace of mind. After searching for a few minutes, he found a carrier that suited him. As he clambered out of his Avenger following the landing, he was greeted with, "That was a beautiful landing, Mr. Russell, just like daytime." Surprise, Russell shot back, "What ship is this?" "Why, it's the Cabot, of course. What did you think it was?" And he said, "That's all I want to know." He fell to his knees and he kissed the deck of the ship.
Well, it wasn't just our planes trying to land in our deck. It turns
Absolutely.
Out Japanese planes would land on the deck as well. Do you want to pick this one or I'm going to grab it?
Well, we can tag team it. Go ahead and tell me what you got.
So from Ian Toll's book, he writes, "The light show attracted at least one confused Japanese pilot who very nearly landed his Aichi dive bomber on the Bella Wood. It flew down the cross leg at a suitable speed and altitude, wheels down, flaps set for landing. Yeah, good pilot. Lieutenant Harper, assuming it was American, signaled too high and waved his paddles, and the plane went higher, suggesting that the pilot was reading the signals improperly. It was banking away when a spotlight revealed the red meatballs on the fuselage. The Bella Wood suddenly darkened, but anti-aircraft gunners didn't have time to react. In retrospect,
Harper regretted that he was unable to coax the plane aboard. Had he done so, it would have been the most dramatic capture in the history of aviation.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I've got the same account in my book, but they say it's this fellow named Proulx that was actually trying to land. Maybe, and I think the plane was trying to land on different ships.
Sure.
Because on this one, he says, towards the end of the evening, he picked up another plane in the landing circle. However, there was something odd about the behavior of the plane. Instead of following the normal landing procedures, this pilot did everything in reverse.
Yeah.
With a high signal, he'd fly higher. With disgust, and so this guy was disgusted. After the third time he waved him off, Proulx shone a light at the plane and was amazed to see the red meatballs. Others aboard the flat top were equally surprised to see this apparition.
Yeah.
The visitor finally flew off and was not seen again. So, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, this plane was probably thinking, he was probably following the group of planes back, thinking it was his own group.
Yeah.
And he was trailing these guys. And he's like, well, what the heck? I might as well land at this point, you know? So it's amazing.
Yeah, totally. So anyway, the next clip that we're going to talk about is the cabin did get damaged. A little bit later in the war, Ira Bewley wasn't on the cabin at the time, but there were incidents that occurred while he was on the ship where it got damaged and also after he left the ship. And he's just going to detail some of these right now.
Was your ship, the Cabot, ever hit or attacked while you were on board?
No, we got some real near misses.
Some near misses.
And
I think they got strafed.
Well, I'd say we got a slight hit. It was a real close miss. It didn't damage us much. But after I left the ship, I guess that was about May 45 when they were taking Okinawa. Mm-hmm. That's when they took a kamikaze. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when the Bunker Hill nearly got sunk.
Yeah.
That deck looked like a junkyard. I saw the ship before they started working on it.
In harbor?
I mean, it was butchered up. And they lost a lot of people in those deals. But we were lucky that the one that we took, we lost about 70 people, I think. And most of those were the Japanese plane sheared the starboard side of the ship. Just kind of come down that way, you know. And 40-millimeter gun mounts. And there was about 7 men per gun mount. And it took all them off. They went all went to sea. They didn't recover any of them.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, so I mean, a little Google foo, and 62 men were killed or wounded from that particular incident. But again, in contrast to some of the Japanese carriers that were hit by a single bomb or two or a torpedo, the careful training and the protocols we put in place for damage control went smoothly and coolly. And in fact, she continued to maintain her station in formation, doing full operation flight activity until repairs could be made in Ulithi Atoll.
Wow.
So the entire starboard series of gun mounts were sheared off. 62 men killed or wounded. There were some fires that were created from that particular event. They put out the fires out and they made the repairs. And then they turned that into the wind and started launching planes again. A lot of the veterans we interview also have interesting stories from some of the more eccentric members that they've had a chance to serve with. And here's a story of one of those right now.
We had one fellow that was, he had perpetual seasickness. And they were going to move him to another job on land. But one night he decided we were anchored. He decided he'd swim home.
So that's it, huh?
You know, I don't know whether you were a little off or not, but then they moved him.
Okay.
Yeah, they got a place for him. And we never did know what happened to him. Never saw him again.
Wow.
I love that. I wish this is one that when we post a video on Facebook, you need to look at that because his eyes get big. He goes, and then they moved him. Like once he did that crazy
took all
shit,
that.
Right? So, I mean, I'm actually surprised more people don't go crazy in these sort of conditions, right?
And that's
so,
obviously what's going on with this guy. I mean, you know, well, he had the perpetual seasickness, but at the same time, to get delirious like this.
And swim home.
Yeah, and you've had perpetual seasickness. Don't you think it's going to get worse if you're swimming? I mean, anyway, he wasn't thinking rashly, obviously, but.
Totally. And so the next clip here talks a bit more about, you know, how was his plane affected? Was there any battle damage during the some of the actions that he served in?
Oh, things that happened that you wouldn't think, you couldn't see how it happened that way. We had a torpedo plane made a run on us one day. And there were three carriers and some destroyers, a battleship in the fleet. And that plane come clear through the fleet and didn't get knocked down. All those ships were really pouring the lead at it. He come over our carrier, he wasn't over 40 feet high, I guess. And the gunners, they were letting him try and knock him down. And they never did knock him down. Fighter plane finally picked him up on the edge of the fleet and got him. But, you know, things like that. Well, it's hard to figure. You take, we made about 50 soul bombing runs.
50?
Combat runs. Jeez. And we never got a scratch. The three of us. We picked up a lot of holes in the plane, things like that, but we never got anything that was fatal. And managed to fly it back. And
Okay. However, in this very next clip, he's going to talk about a crash landing.
We had a crash landing aboard ship one time.
Oh, really?
And we landed, there's seven cables and a barrier where you land. Number three or four cable is the one you want, is the best one. And our hook, the carrier was rolling and pitching quite a bit that day. And our hook got in a rhythm, bounced over every one of the wires. And the fellow who was operating the barrier thought we had a wire, and he had dropped the barrier. So we went right on through and hooked our starboard wing on the island of the carrier and we spun us around into 40-millimeter gun mount. And we were sitting there, boy, it was touch and go. We figured if we moved, the plane would go in the water.
So you were on the edge of the ship?
Yeah, we were right on the edge of the deck, you know. But they got us out of there, and then pushed the plane over the side because it was banged up pretty good.
Now, wait just a damn minute. First off, this is very late in the interview where I learned that he did the crash landing. I also asked him, hey, what's the most harrowing or frightening moment you had? And he talks about the night landing. And then it's almost as an afterthought. You know, we're getting towards the end of the interview. We're just kind of talking about different anecdotes. Oh, yeah, by the way, I had this crash landing and almost went into the water. I mean, this is... It's amazing how often these veterans have these very harrowing stories about things that happen, and they're just kind of them.
Well, you know, I mean, I would think that maybe with all the action he's gone through, that wasn't one of his more harrowing moments.
but that's what's so funny about this, is that this is just kind of, oh, yeah, so I told you some cool stuff, and all right, we'll just talk about the crash landing for a second or two.
I mean, in his head, he's probably weighing all the things that, you know, and the fact that he landed in the daytime on this crash landing. If he did go over the side, he probably, well, they'll pick me. They'll fish me out of the water. No big deal. You know, so, yeah, amazing.
It is amazing. And so the next clip that we're going to talk about is being lucky.
You know, when someone watches, you know, the movies of these bombing runs, you always see the plane being knocked around and all that. Is that a true representation? Could you kind of tell us what a bombing run on a naval vessel is really like?
Well, that was really the most dangerous part of bombing.
Was
because on land, your guns, the enemy guns, were dispersed. Whereas in a fleet, while they're jammed together and bombing, they throw the firepower if you happen to get in. And I really don't know. You know, you see these pictures of the dive bombers bombing ships like the Battle of Midway and those things. I saw one dive bomber get shot out. And I saw one of the wing come off the plane. Oh. It was the only two real fatalities that I ever saw in that position. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're running on those fleets, you've got such a screen coming at you that I think luck plays a lot of big part of it. Mm-hmm. It like those boys up there, you know, Ensign Gay, you've mm-hmm. heard of him. He was just lucky. Mm-hmm. And all the other probably got shot down in that quadrant, torpedo 8. Mm-hmm. And I consider the three of us real lucky. Because I think we had to have some luck because we made, you know, bombing runs, torpedo runs, and managed to stay together and get back.
Yeah, just so he's referring to Ensign Gay in Torpedo 8. He's talking about the Battle of Midway there, just for anyone who doesn't know what he's talking about. So
yeah, and you know, so there you heard it. You heard it straight from someone who flew 50 sorties, 50 missions, bombing ships, villages, you name it, whatever needed to be bombed or strafed, about what it was like to be in a bombing run. And it goes back to kind of that philosophical question about, you know, luck or fate or divine intervention. And Ira's viewpoint on this is they were just damn lucky. Mm-hmm. So we're going to roll into the next clip here. And this one is about a memory or recollection that he had about a ground attack in Guam.
One last question about your time in the theater. You mentioned a number of times that you would do, was it close air ground support? Did you ever do close air ground support for our ground troops? Or was it mostly bombing runs to soften up positions?
We drop bombed ahead of the Marines when they were making landings. We used what they call anti-personnel bombs. And they were just a jump bomb filled with nuts and bolts and went off about waist high.
Did not know that.
I didn't either.
They were anti-personnel, what they were for. We did that quite a bit, and sometimes, well, like Guam, for instance, we got a call one day. We were in the vicinity. We dropped bombs, but we didn't have any bombs left, but we had all of our ammunition. And there were several other planes, the same fix. The Marines had a group of Japanese kind of hemmed up against a cliff. But the Japanese evidently had some, whether it was a mortar or what, I don't know. But they were giving them a bad time, and they called for support. And we went in and strafed. The pilot had 250 caliber, I had 50 caliber. And the gunner, the radio man, had a 30 caliber. And there's four or five planos went in there and strafed. In a minute, where we got a call thanking us. And that's the way it went, you know, on some of those deals.
Yeah, some of the pilots that we've interviewed who have had a chance to do ground support, they feel really validated by that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing.
I think I would too.
So would I. I mean, it's, and from some of the comments that they've made to me, and we'll hear in subsequent episodes, so please subscribe to our podcast. you're gonna hear them say things like, when we were bombing ships or cities or villages, you know, we were, you know, killing people, and we're not exactly sure how indiscriminate it was. But when you're doing close air support and everything's marked out right, not only are you focused on, you know, killing an enemy, but you're saving men that you can hear over your radio. And so I wanted to include this clip because I'd be willing to bet that's not the only time he did that.
Sure.
Right. It's just one of his memories, and it's something that was really important to him. But you know what? Not everything goes well in a theater of operations, and sometimes accidents do occur. And this next clip talks a little bit about that.
And we were down in New Guinea, and let's see, I can't think of the name of that island now. Anyway, it was off of the north quadrant of New Guinea. And these fellows had moved in on the beach, but they were in a sector that they weren't supposed to be in at that time of day. And I know that we killed some of them because we went in there and strafed and found out later that they had moved into that area. Mm. And those things happened.
Yeah.
Like there was quite a bit of animosity between the submariners and the flyers.
Really?
Because a submarine got hit occasionally with a friendly bomb. That happened.
Interesting.
But it didn't happen as many times as I would figure it would happen, you know.
So I don't know how the different Japanese, how different it is between a Japanese and American sub from the air. How would you tell? It's not like they're flying a flag.
No, they're not. And in fact, a lot of times they'd be at the surface at night or right. in the evening, and they would be submerged during the day. So you're dealing with waves, low light conditions, ships that look very similar. And so I thought his comment at the end was very prescient, which was, it didn't happen as often as you would have thought. So basically that message in that clip, as I interpret it, was, hey, there's some friendly fire. And there were times where our planes would sink our own submarines. But given the nature of warfare, it's kind of a miracle that we didn't, you know, have that happen more frequently.
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was watching your expression as you were listening to this clip. And the first time I heard this clip, a few days ago, prior to that, it was, you know, in 2003, when he was saying that, when he said that the submariners had problems with them, you had this look in your face like, what? Why? And I was doing the same thing.
You were
doing
it on the tape.
Yeah, I'm kind of like, why would the submariners have a problem with it? And you know what? The subs were such an existential threat to these fleets. They were so dangerous that I think a lot of these flyers erred on the side of caution. They saw a sub, they just sank it. Okay, so we got a few more clips here. This is a clip where he talks a bit about his crew and about Air Group 31 generally.
Well, you mentioned your crew a few times.
Uh-huh.
What was the relationship like with your crew?
Well, it's kind of like I asked the pilot one time when we first started flying together.
Lieutenant Edward Wood.
See, we flew together about 20 months.
Oh, okay.
I asked him, I said, what do you want me to call you? He said, well, when we're on a ship, then you can call me Mr. Woods. I said, with an airplane, why you can just call me anything? And so that's kind of the way it went, you know. But we had a real good crew. I would bet that we had as good a crew as the one in the Pacific. Because we knew each other's weaknesses, strong points, and we could talk to one another. And it worked, you know, for us. So some of those crews didn't get along too good because for one reason, see, the pilot was an officer. Mm-hmm. And the crews, most of the time, were enlisted people. And they wanted their crew to know that they were officers.
That's what you're saying.
And there was, some of that went on. But we didn't have any problem along that line. It's just like he said, we called him Mr. Board of Ship.
But up in the air, it was whatever.
Yep, that's right.
Now, that's quite a statement when he says that they may have been one of the best crews in the Pacific. Let's back that up.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the squadron that he was a part of, Air Group 31, this is a quote, the Squadron 31 was the highest scoring CVL, light carrier squadron, and the fourth highest scoring squadron, which included the fleet carriers, which had three times as many planes. They had the highest kill ratio per pilot of any squadron in the U.S. Navy, which is a record that stands to this day.
That's crazy.
So when I first heard, it is crazy. When I first heard Iris say that, it's like, well, that's good. They developed an esprit de corps.
Everybody feels like that.
You should feel like you're on a winning team. And then after doing some research on VF-31, it turns out they were a very special and gifted squadron that has records that hold to this day, which I think is phenomenal.
And do you know their name?
No, I do not.
So you know how they're a lot of times they're like the flying whatevers, you know?
Yeah.
They were the meat cleavers.
Oh.
Is that not awesome?
Oh my God, dude, that was destiny. You can't be called the meat cleavers and come out of the war with some, you know, half-assed number of kills.
It's just like being born and your name's Butch.
Yeah, or John Swift.
You better be a Butch.
You
yeah.
better run fast. Wow. All right. So the next clip is some of his recollections about VJ Day when finally this god-awful war was over.
Yeah, I was at Los Alamitos. That was this little Navy base around Long Beach. I was there. I remember very well.
What were your emotions? How'd you feel?
Well, we had talked about all of this, when we were waiting on flights to come back in, we'd be resting under the wing of an airplane, you know, or something. And somebody'd say what they were going to do when they got home, got discharged. And somebody'd say, well, how do you know when you're going to get discharged? Well, it'll end someday, you know. And but most people, there was a lot of celebration went on that night.
Okay.
Around Long Beach there. And then another fellow went out, had a few beers. We didn't stay long. We'd come back in because it was getting pretty wild places. But I was ready to get out because I'd been in 3.5 years.
3.5 years. Over a year of which was strictly training. Another effectively a year out at sea if you include the breakdown cruise. And then he spent, you know, 8 or 9 months or so helping to train the pilots going overseas. And the war was finally over for him. He at the end of the war, he's a sergeant major, which is a very high non-com rank. He was a decorated veteran,
master
and a war
sergeant.
Hero. Master sergeant, what did I say?
Sergeant major.
Sergeant, yeah, thank you, master sergeant. And now in the final clip, he's going to talk about what he did after the war.
And then one day I was walking down the street in Fort Worth, Texas, and I saw a fellow across the street I thought I'd ought to know. I went over and looked at him closer, and I knew who he was. He was a school teacher that had taught me here before in high school. And I said, what are you doing this neck of the woods? He said, well, I'm on a hiring expedition. And I work for the Celanese Chemical Company. And so I'm located in Bishop, Texas, and I'm looking for people. And he said, you wouldn't be interested, would you? I said, well, I might be. He said, well, you got to have 5 years experience or 2 years college. And I had the college. So I went over and talked to him. He was at the employment office. And he had me fill out some papers, you know. He said, if you pass physical, you're hired. So I went down, took the physical, went to work, worked for him 37 years.
And that's what a lot of vets did after the war. There's Bruce Springsteen songs that are sung about this, where these guys got out of the war, they were able to work at a place until they retired, which is so foreign nowadays, right? Mm-hmm. In the 21st century, where everyone kind of has this free agent mentality and there's not as much company loyalty as there used to be. And this goes full circle. That chemical plant brought him back into Pampa, Texas area, the panhandle. And then ultimately we were able to connect with him. Just Ira Bewley, this interview was conducted in 03. He passed away in 2012. And he has a son named John Bewley who lives in Denver, which is where this is being recorded right now, and a daughter in Golden, Colorado. So we really enjoyed talking about Ira Bewley today. We hope that you enjoyed the content. And in fact, the Pampa Army Museum is still a thing. And Ryan, I think you had a chance to visit it recently, right?
Yeah, on my way here to your house. so yeah, like Tony said, we're actually recording. Usually we all the episodes prior to this, we've been recording in my house in Bixby, Oklahoma area, but decided to take the trip out here this time, pack all the gear up and come out here. Well, you know, knowing that we interviewed Ira at Pampa, you know, back in 2003, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be by myself driving. I'm going to take the long scenic route and I'm going to go through Pampa. I got to Pampa around 2 o'clock, 2 days ago and went in and, immediately, met a few people that I'd only corresponded with on email from 2003. And, they've got a great museum there. If you get a chance, like I said at the beginning, make sure you stop by and visit it. Go to the webpage. They've got a webpage also, but I wanted to pay homage to Ira. And so they have a wing there that's kind of their hall of honor. And they have all these pictures of all these guys. And we're going to be featuring a lot more of these guys, you know, in the future and everything. But it was just a real honor. I mean, Tony was the one who actually got to interview him and everything. But, you know, what a fascinating story. What a fantastic experience and contribution he made.
Yeah. And so we hope you enjoyed the interview today during our podcast. We were hoping that we could amplify some of the things and experiences that were in his interview with our own commentary. And by all means, if you enjoyed what you heard today in a previous podcast, please subscribe to our podcast.
Please hit subscribe.
So with that, I'm Tony Lupo.
And I'm Ryan Fairfield.
And thanks for listening today.
Well, thanks for joining us. If you like what you hear, please like us at the Warrior Next Door podcast Facebook page. Feel free to post your questions and we'll try to answer them in the next series of interviews that we do.